Well, some of the more recent signs of climate change include things like hurricanes, tropical storms, and sheets of ice set adrift off Greenland. We'll be talking about that today with our two guests. Thanks for staying with us here on the Ideas Network, by the way. Larry Mueller here. Our weather guys joining us once again, Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Larry. Great to be here.
Also with us today, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. And John, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. How you doing?
I'm doing well. We've got a lot to talk about today with the recent severe weather events and what they have to say about climate change. And we'll take your weather-related comments and questions as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, we've had a lot of extreme weather activity in the last few weeks, and wondering how does it relate to climate change?
Well, aspects of it are almost certainly related to climate change. It's safe to say, though, that there's an enormous amount of variability in the day-to-day weather that that has no explanation that lies in the changing climate. But when you sift and winnow, and of course that's what we do at Wisconsin, we do that all the time. We're trying to do that in all kinds of different areas. But when you do it with weather systems over, you know, many decades and various things like that, you begin to realize, you know, the amount of wildfire damage and the earliness in the season of the wildfires in California and the West is unusual, and it's coincident with a warming and therefore a drying of the vegetation in the western U.S., and the warming is tied to climate change. The types of the incredible prolific nature of the hurricane season in the Atlantic Basin this year reminds us of 2005 is really not normal. And so it's, again, consistent with the idea that if the planet's warming a little bit, the ocean surface temperature and the deep ocean heat content is also going up. And those are the very things that fuel frequent tropical storms and hurricanes. And so it isn't difficult and it's not really challenging to come to the conclusion that these things are related to a background change in the climate. On the other hand, I'll just finish. I know this is a long answer. This is just one other thing. We haven't been 80 degrees since the 4th of September here in Madison. And we may then, therefore, with this cold week coming up, we might make a run at the earliest last 80-degree temperature for the season. And the earliest one ever was September 2nd, 1977. We won't beat the record, but we might find ourselves in second place. That weird little thing is not really an artifact of climate change. That's just part of the variability.
Marvin in Monroe has been hanging on for a bit to ask or make his comments, so let's go there. Marvin, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. Yes, I just wanted to comment that I think that it's great that we're trying to control carbon emissions and all that. But as our guest, I'm sure, is going to bring up in just a few minutes, it seems as if the Greenland ice sheet is melting at an unprecedented scale. And from what little I've been able to put together, it seems like we've almost lost it. We're going to lose the bulk of that ice sheet within the next 20 or 30 years. It's going to be gone. But the thing that concerns me is, there's nothing we can do about it. If the United States and Canada were going to stop zero emissions today, that would still be gone. And nobody wants to talk about the fact that there isn't too much we can do for the rest of the world. We're going to continue to pollute, and passing laws is not going to solve the problem. Not right away. And it's going to take over 150 years in order to make an appreciable change if the rest of the world gets on board. And I'd just like him to comment on that.
All right. Have we passed the point of no return? I think is sort of what Marvin's getting at there.
Well, yeah, I guess I would say, you know, let's not just give up here. I mean, there is a continuation. So as Marvin's pointed out or suggesting, even if we were to stop all, you know, carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere, we would continue to see a warming because we've done the damage already. Now, that warming won't increase as fast, and it'll level off. And so I think that rather than, you know, take the, oh, it's too late, we've done the damage type of attitude, I think it's much more productive to try and take it on. That is what we did, I think, is a good example with the ozone hole in Antarctica. Once we really understood what the cause was, the damage had been done in terms of human activities and CFCs. But, you know, the world got together and we came up with a plan to reduce the impact of what we were doing on the ozone hole. The same thing with acid rain. You know, a lot of damage was done before we did the legislation and figured out what was the right legislation. And so I think that that's a much better approach than just saying, well, it's too late now. But Marvin does point out, you know, we're seeing the effects of climate warming on the Arctic in terms of the sea ice, but also the Greenland ice sheets. They are rapidly, you know, breaking apart. We just saw, I think it was a 42-square-mile section break off, and that'll move into the ocean and melt. So, yeah, the impact continues, but, you know, let's be positive and try and figure out what it is that we can change and mitigate and adapt to what those changes are.
Yeah. Marvin, thanks again. You were going to add something there, John?
Well, I completely agree with everything Steve said, and Marvin does bring up good points, but you can't lead from behind, and that's what we've kind of put ourselves in a position to do here in the U.S. We can change that. I think a lot of people in October 1957 were probably nervous that the Soviets had put the first man in space, but I bet you there wasn't a hue and cry about, well, the game's over, we better not worry about a space race because, you know, they already beat us, so that game's already lost. We didn't have that attitude in 1957, and there was a great amount of progress that was the result of never adopting that attitude. I'm not quite sure why we seem to want to adopt a America can't attitude just because we have competitor nations who are flagrantly violating some of the rules and norms that we'd like them to adopt. The way to make them adopt them is not to say, well, you're right, you can do whatever you want, we're not going to put any pressure on you. I don't understand that.
John in Madison kind of has something to go along with that. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I echo the sentiments of what the other John said. When I hear that if we do something and other countries don't, that will negate our good efforts, that sounds like the same argument that those other countries would be making. You know, if we make efforts but the United States doesn't, then what's the point? And I mean, I think we're already kind of, with the other caller's comments with the deterioration of Greenland, I think we already are kind of too late to stop the desert planet with the acidic ocean. But at this point, it's kind of how far are we going to push it? How far is that desert line going to go in the latitude of our planet?
Yeah. Steve, a comment?
Yeah, no, I would agree. Right. I think John is, you know, saying what is it agreeing with what we're agreeing with. It's like, let's, you know, so we've had impact. That doesn't mean we just walk away from it. We got to understand it and find ways to deal with it.
Yeah.
And pretending it doesn't exist or ignoring that it exists is not the solution.
Yeah.
It is not.
Where does the... you wonder what is the United Nations or who should be taking more of a role in this?
Well, we had the Paris Accord on climate in 2015-16, and then we just backed out of it for no really good reason. And that was hammered together, you know, with the work. It was based on the work of thousands of scientists over a period of really 25 or 30 years, where many of the nations around the world, I think it was 141 of them, had agreed, yeah, we've got a crisis that we need to meet. And the United States, of course, is a great nation, and we need to be at the front of those efforts for such challenges. And we've completely abandoned that challenge in the last 3 or 4 years. And there's no good reason for that. It's just, it seems petulant. Doesn't seem like it was well thought out.
Vern called to ask what you can say about global dimming. And I'm not sure what he means by global dimming.
Maybe, Steve, is that maybe the putting aerosols in the atmosphere and dimming the amount of incoming solar radiation? Is that what people refer to that as?
I think that's what it is, yeah. So you have more aerosols in the atmosphere, more energy reflects back out to space, less solar energy gets to the ground, which would cause a cooling. And, you know, it's part of what some have postulated could be done with geoengineering. But I know I'll speak for John on this because I'm going to bet that he feels the same way, is that, you know, intentionally putting particles in the atmosphere in order to reflect more solar energy. You know, we don't understand the atmosphere to that degree to be able to do that kind of activity and understand what the real impact is going to be.
That's correct, Steve. I agree with you.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman are weather guys with us, and they'll be with us right up to 12:30 today. We are going to take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with them, and you can ask your questions. And here's the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us with your weather questions at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, back with us, professors in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. If you have a weather question, I hope you'll join in. If you notice something interesting about the weather lately, question about climate, join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And guys, we have Andrew in Green Bay on the line now. So let's go to Andrew and see what's on Andrew's mind. Hi there, Andrew.
Hi, Steve, John, and Larry. Thanks for having me on.
Sure, welcome.
My question is about the climate prediction models that are showing Wisconsin will have about the same kind of climate as Missouri by 2050. My question about that is, are we going to see the severe weather events like tornadoes and El Derechos that are more common down there, as well as the extreme for us heat like they have, and also the mild, are we going to get more mild winters out of something like that? And if that's going to be a fairly drastic change, or if it's going to kind of ebb and flow as we get closer to that 2050 mark.
Okay. Let's see. John, do you want to start? Yeah. Or no, Steve, you're going to start?
Yeah, I'll start and then turn over the do the easy part and then let John do the harder part. Because that's an excellent question. And so what I think they do in those maps is they project out what is it going to look like in terms of the temperature for Wisconsin 50 years from now. What does the precipitation look like as well? And they may really just focus on the temperature. And then based on that mean temperature, which we know is going to warm and therefore make the winters warmer, to that one comment, they move south until they find a state that has that kind of temperature now. And so points to that state for us, which is maybe Illinois or Indiana or Missouri, depending on how far out you go. Now, when you start talking about severe weather, it becomes more than just what is the temperature and the moisture. You start having to look at what is the atmospheric structure. You know, is it warm and moist in the ground and cooler above? And where's the jet stream? And I think those maps don't include that aspect of what is our state going to look like in terms of the weather of another state. Does that sound right, John?
I think you're exactly right, Steve. Couldn't have said it better and more comprehensively. The temperature and precipitation averages that come out of these models can be pinned to another spot in the country, and then you can make an adjustment like that. But there's physiographic factors, there's other factors that are not really directly taken account of make some difference in the types of weather that arrive at a place. And then also one other comment I would add is that the average of say, Green Bay 50 years from now is probably going to be warmer and therefore a shorter winter and probably a few more hot summer days on average. But an individual summer or an individual winter could very well relapse back to what we remember from the 1940s or 50s in a given year, because there's enough variability in the system, and the variability includes these features that Steve just mentioned, like where's the jet in a certain winter and what's the circulation around the northern hemisphere look like. Those are variable enough, even in a warmer climate, that you can still occasionally get something that'll look like the remote past. But it's more likely that in 9 or 8 out of 10 straight winters, you're going to have a shorter winter than you used to. And I think that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Lisa in Janesville has something kind of relates, I think. So let's go there. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I just have a comment regarding an observation. I grew up an hour north of Green Bay, right near the UP. And in the 70s, I grew up on a lake. And we could be out ice skating usually by November, by Thanksgiving as a kid. That was kind of our time to get out there. My mother still lives there. And the last 10 to 15 years, oftentimes the lake isn't frozen over in January or even February. And it's pretty consistent. Maybe one year it is, but most of the years it's not.
Yeah. That's a really hard signal to argue with, isn't it? When you have a recollection or a long time series, to put it in more clinical terms, of a certain lake in a certain location freezing on average on a certain date, and then it's moving later, and then the ice comes off earlier. Pretty hard to argue with that.
Yeah, and I think seeing that not just in people's impressions, but in data measurements. So, you know, like the lakes around here have for 100 years been taking observations of when is the lake first frozen, and had a pretty rigorous definition of what that means. And we're seeing that move later in the year, and then the ice breaking up earlier in the year. So the time that the lake is frozen is getting shorter, and it's a direct consequence of global warming.
That's right. And John Magnuson in the Center for Limnology here on our campus wrote a very famous paper in the year 2000, I think it was, where he looked at 38 different lakes, larger lakes than probably the one you grew up near, but large lakes around the northern hemisphere that are fairly widely distributed, so not all in one spot in the northern hemisphere, and looked at the ice off dates from 1846 to 1995, 150 years, just like Steve's talking about, and even widespread around the whole hemisphere. The average shortening of the ice on season was almost 19 days over that 150 years. On all of that, taking all of that variability into account, still get that average of a shorter winter by 19 days by that measure. So it's happened. This is one clear signal.
And that's almost three weeks. That's almost a whole month.
That's
really amazing.
That's stunning, isn't it? Yep.
Thank you very much for that comment and question. Mary in Minocqua emailed to ask if you could tell us any weather predictions for northern Wisconsin as far as precipitation and temperature.
Well, I'll go out on a limb here. I'll take the bait. There's a La Nina brewing in the Pacific right now, which means we don't have a really strong global scale phenomena that's going to exert any control on the nature of our winter in the upper Midwest this year, at least not as statistically substantial of an impact. So I would say that chances are probably about 50-50 that you're going to get what looks like an old-style winter up north and in the Lake Superior region. So far, we've had a relatively cool late summer and early fall, and there's no particular reason to see that changing. I've seen longer-term forecast maps, but these are 10 to 14 days, and nothing substantially different seems in the offing, at least in those 2 weeks. Sometimes when you get off to an early start that's cool, it can last cool all the way through December, and that would mean in the Lake Superior region you get a lot of lake effect snow in that first couple of months of the cold season. So that's what I'm going to say is my guess, but it is a guess. It's not really anything more than a guess.
Okay. Oh, man. Gail emailed that she just read that normal, quote, normal, gets recalculated every 10 years by NOAA, and this obscures the real rise in temperatures. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah, so that's true. It's every 10 years they do a 30-year average, and that becomes your new normal for Madison or for whatever city. When we do look at climate change in terms of temperature, we often fix that 30-year period between 1960 to 1990. And so that is sort of the comparison year. So you don't actually lose what the temperature trends are doing.
That makes sense. Lynn in Marengo, your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Yes, good morning. Question for you. In 2017, my brother and I went to Nebraska to look at the eclipse. And when it was in totality, we've experienced a 360-degree either sunset or sunrise. It was absolutely the most stunning thing I've ever witnessed in my life. But it was beautiful. It was like a, it was just like a sunrise all the way around. Can you explain that phenomenon?
Steve, I'll turn to you for that.
Yeah, you know, I'll say a couple of things. One is, and hope Lynn will probably too attest to this, but I went and watched the solar eclipse in Wyoming and drove through Nebraska. And once you see a total solar eclipse, man, you got to go see another one. This is actually my second one. I saw one in 1979 because it is so unbelievably cool in what happens. And so the sky color does change. It does get darker because you're really blotting out the sun. And the only thing you get to see is the corona around that. And, you know, it changes your temperature, drops down because you are, you know, turning off the solar energy and you're doing that at a relatively quick time period. Instead of a 24-hour day, you're just doing it within maybe a couple of hours. So I'm not sure why it would look like a sunrise or a sunset, which tend to be, when I think of that, I think of the orangey colors. But I might be thinking of it wrong. And now as I reflect back in Wyoming, it does look like a sunset or a sunrise because there's so much less solar energy. And so in a sunrise sunset, the sun is actually below the horizon. So a lot of that energy is being blocked out. And all you're seeing is the scattered energy from the sun. So I would say that's probably what's going on with a solar eclipse. You're blocking out a lot of the sun. But not all of it. And so you see energy coming from the corona that gets scattered around in the molecules that are in the atmosphere.
And I remember reading that it kind of screwed up the birds a little bit when that occurred.
Yeah. When I saw the one in Wyoming, the bird patterns, they just get off and they take off. I saw one in 79. It was like in an open field with a bunch of cattle. As soon as it got dark, the cattle just started heading to the ranch. They all just stopped eating and started moving because it was getting dark. So it's really a three-dimensional visual physical experience that is very much different than watching it on television or in some other way.
Yeah. Cindy in Milwaukee emailed to say it seems to her it's become more difficult to accurately forecast the weather. She's wondering if climate change makes it more difficult to use models based on historical data.
I would say that's not a correct statement of the current status quo. The models that make the day-to-day weather predictions don't really care about statistics anyway, except insofar as the statistics are about their prior performance. But boy, I was just commenting today how we had the really substantial rains yesterday afternoon when the front came through, and then the forecast models had this little piddly rain event behind them on Thursday and Friday in the forecast for today. And I kept thinking to myself, boy, that doesn't seem like it's going to happen. Why do they insist on having this little light rain well behind the front? I can't think of why that would be the case. Sure enough, light rain today, exactly as forecasted. So my impression is just the opposite, that the forecasting on the day-to-day, 2 to 3 day ranges just keeps on getting better. It's an absolutely remarkable, it's a miracle of the modern age that we have this kind of accuracy. So I know it still can be disappointing on a given day, but if you keep score every day, you're not going to be disappointed with the rate of return on that, I don't think.
Yeah. Let's turn to Dennis in the casino next. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Well, good morning or good afternoon, as the case may be, and thanks for the receiver call. I would appreciate it if your authorities would comment on our atmospheric canopy, what would happen if we had none, and what happens to the canopy to induce climate change.
So when I hear the word canopy, I'm thinking of the vegetation canopy. Is that what you mean, Dennis?
The atmospheric canopy.
So...
yeah, I don't know what that means, unless it's...
yeah.
Could you explain a little more what you mean, Dennis?
It's our atmosphere. It's all over... it's what envelops the world.
Yeah, so just the atmosphere itself.
Okay,
so I've just never heard it referred to that way. So you just mean the atmosphere itself. Yeah, okay. Okay, Steve, were you going to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, the atmosphere itself is what is driving some of the changes, of course, because the chemical composition of the atmosphere is not constant. And so this giant, you know, 6 billion billion ton gaseous envelope that surrounds the Earth has different chemicals in it, and some of those chemicals have, well, many of the chemicals have different properties in terms of the way they deal with radiation when you compare them from one to the other. Chemicals like oxygen, nitrogen, which make up only about 98% of our atmosphere, almost do no absorbing at all of incoming solar radiation, and they don't do very much absorbing of outgoing infrared that the surface of the planet and everything that lives on it emits. But gases like carbon dioxide and ozone and water vapor are quite different in that regard. They don't do too much absorbing of incoming radiation from the sun, but they do an enormous amount of absorbing of outgoing infrared, and that's what makes our planet habitable, given how far away we are from the sun. So if you start turning up the crank on things like carbon dioxide fraction and methane fraction, maybe some other nitrous oxide fractions, you start to change the way that the atmosphere actually deals with the radiation that is incident on it, either from the sun or from the underlying surface. And that changes the temperature of the planet.
Yeah. And the only thing I'll add is I think the reason why John and I were confused is that in our discipline, when you use the word canopy, we're often thinking about the vegetation canopy. So the vegetation
right.
on the ground. And there's a lot of interaction there between the vegetation and the atmosphere as well in terms of energy and moisture.
Ah, there we go. Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe on a less dramatic note, let's talk about we're officially into autumn. Someone was wondering how do shortened daylight hours affect weather?
Yeah, that's my cup of tea. I love thinking about that. The shorter the daytime, the colder it gets with increasing latitude. So already at the North Pole, the sun's down and it isn't coming back up till March 21st. And little bit south of there now, only a very little bit south of there, the same thing is now going on. So you have an eternal night at the high latitudes of the northern hemisphere, and that just allows the air to cool ceaselessly because it never gets a part of the day where it's going to be heated by sunshine. So the colder the air gets at high latitudes, the faster the jet stream winds rev up in the northern hemisphere circulation, and they start to carry with them really intense weather systems, and so it gets to be a really exciting time. The so-called cold season is filled with monster storms, and that are really impressive, and the ones that eventually bring us snow are a couple of months from now. So it starts to get very exciting.
Yeah, it gets exciting. There's no question about that.
It gets exciting, right?
How are the September weather stats looking? Seemed fairly normal, but now it seems cool.
I don't know off the top of my head. The curious thing is we've only had the one day of 80 degrees, the 4th of September. That is unusual for September. We usually have more than one. But I don't know about the average temperature because we've had fluctuating periods of chilly weather. Now this will be the second chilly week of the month. So I guess, try to make a guess without looking at the stats, I'd say we're going to be a little below normal for September. But we had a warm week in between, too, so I don't know.
And, yeah, I had looked at the Midwest Climate Center, and they, in analyzing the data for Wisconsin, most of Wisconsin was 1 to 2 degrees below normal temperature
okay.
for September so far. So you're spot on there. Yep.
Oh, good.
I went on Facebook this weekend, just took a quick look, and I saw all the wonderful pictures of people who had been out looking at the changes in the color of the trees. There's some beautiful shots there. What impact? How does the weather affect that tree coloration?
Yeah, it can make it look brilliant, or it can destroy the viewing really quickly. right? It's a darn new weather. You know, the good kind of weather we want is daytime where it's nice and sunny, and then nighttime where it gets cool, not frosty, but, you know, into the 40, low 40s. And that'll tend to generate the brilliant fall colors. If you have a lot of cloudy days and very warm nights, then you get a very drab autumn color. Also, you know, the freezes and the frost, when you get that, that's not good for color either. And then, of course, if you get storms, they'll just, you know, blow the leaves off the trees, and you won't get very many colors that way either.
And one other question, how has the pandemic affected what you do for the university, John?
Oh, man, it's been, I mean, everybody's had major adjustments in their lives, just everybody has, but it's a little bit difficult to do collaborative research with colleagues and graduate students because we have to do all of our meetings online, and so there's a lot of, you know, sort of casual contact with learned and learning colleagues that adds up to productivity that has been subtracted from the equation during this time. So that's a little frustrating and difficult sometimes to deal with. And then the teaching situation has been up and down. I started this semester face-to-face. I'm going to go back to that this week, which I'm very happy about. I hope it'll persist. So I think the students are taking the brunt of the trouble in that regard, because they really would like to get the face-to-face contact with scholars who are experts in the field. I mean, that's what University of Wisconsin's done. It's organized over 2,000 people who are the top people in the world on what they do. And, you know, when you get a class with one of those people, you want to have your hand up, asking as many questions as you can. That's the whole idea. It's a little bit harder to do electronically. So that's been disappointing, I'm sure, for them and certainly for me. I hope that we'll return for good starting this week.
And Steve, in your new role as Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education, I'm sure you haven't had anything change in your life.
No, I haven't had nothing change. You know, I agree 100% with what John said. And yeah, in my role up here, I'm trying to get research going and instruction going again. I don't know where the summer went. The summer just was gone.
Yeah, boy.
Well, in an hour and a half, I'll be teaching a class online myself. So I kind of understand all you guys are talking about. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit on Monday, October 26th. Thanks, John and Steve. Appreciate it. John Martin, professor, and Steve Ackerman, also professor, but he's also vice chancellor for research and grad education, both at UW-Madison. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. We're going to talk tomorrow about finding a career that you love, among other things. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.